Back four on the right side, down in the front. No one's safe. Or this class and the other class.
Okay. Who does it go to?
What?
Who does it go to?
I have to turn it in. Wait a minute. Just a minute. Really?
Yeah, some of them sound really...
Where's Neil?
He's checking off the drawings.
Okay. I should have a disc. There you go. We got them all in? Yeah. All papers? I mean, you got...
Yeah,
there's a pile. Huh? I just want to make sure you got them all.
Yeah, they're concise.
No 5-page papers like that.
That's good. See you all in the front. You don't want to get too close. I mean, that's close is only good in horseshoes and hand grenades, right? Okay, now that you've done the paper topics, any questions that you might have about where we are, where you've been?
You can modify the topic if you need
to. I will make sure that all topics are modified to my discretion, so you don't have to worry about it. Rest assured, okay? I will make sure that you will receive adequate notice. All right, this is midterm. We got this far, and we will have a conceptual break in a certain way. And next week, we're going to be talking about modernism, and we will start with Adolf Loos. I really want you to read for next week nothing of the introduction. Introductory reading, but I would like you to read Massimo Cacciari's The Architecture of Nihilism, Chapter 12, Chapter 14, Chapter 19, and the Epilogue. All right? So that's the only reading that I would like to have you do. Okay. So let's begin. I'm supposed to push this button. Into it. Okay. Piranesi is another end and a beginning. He comes just before the French Revolution. He is a delineator, and he makes his living selling prints of Roman views and ruins. He's also an architect, and he also has a sense of that the world is changing. And I would argue that if, in fact, Brunelleschi represents a beginning of what Michel Foucault calls an epistemic change, or an episteme, that is a radical change in the sensibility of the relationship between God, man, and nature. So too will the French Revolution be an epistemic change. And it will be a change in many respects. what Foucault says in his book, The Archaeology of Knowledge, is that with the advent of a mass society, in other words, the consciousness of a mass society, there is a consciousness of not only the disciplines necessary to understand social behavior, that is, the social sciences, basically politics, economics, and sociology. But what happens in the social science is that when man, i.e. generic man, men and women, generically studies man, man can no longer occupy the center. In other words, to study man means to displace man, but also to have two conditions of man. That is, the object and the subject. And that's a new condition. So, this is what Foucault calls an epistemic shift, and I would say that around 1450, with the movement from theocentrism to anthropocentrism, and then this shift from anthropocentrism to you can call it technocentrism, social centrism, whatever you want, but there is probably an absence in the center. In other words, it's not clearly defined. And that absence is the opening to a whole series of new ideas about the relationship of the subject to object, but the subject to him or herself. and what you get in the study of psychology is what was probably always there but unable to be realized in the desire to hold center in consciousness, is the introduction in psychology of the notion of a collective unconscious. That is, you have a collective consciousness about the mass, but at the same time, there is this anxiety about the stability of the idea of mass and the relationship of the mass to the individual. The mass, that is, the civic population, let's say, which is now the articulator of new institutions, prisons, schools, factories, sanatoria, all kinds of things that deal with social welfare and social behavior. In other words, there are also new jobs for architects, and we begin to get architectural books that deal with typologies, different typologies, how you can take classical orders and use them in different way for a school, for a factory, for a hospital, for a prison, all new functions that never had been articulated before. And we get many, many academic source books that tell us how we can read and employ classical ordination. The idea of modernism, for me, therefore, is underpinned by, one, the notion of a social consciousness, and with that social consciousness, the idea of a collective consciousness, that is, a will, a geist of the epoch of one's time, and which is then becomes a propelling force and is picked up by someone like Karl Marx and Hegel as a historicism, that is, as a force that moves from the past inevitably to the future. And you will see when we get to Mies van der Rohe that Mies van der Rohe says that architecture is the will of the epoch translated into steel and glass, in his particular case, in modern architecture. I believe that architecture, as we said from the get-go, from the beginning of anthropocentrism, stands against the will of the epoch. That is, tries to find ways to transform and stand against this notion of history as a propelling agent. And there's a great Paul Klee drawing that shows the angel of history, the Angelus Novus, being pushed into the future, looking back at history, but unable to maintain its place. And there's a great Laurie Anderson song that talks about Hansel and Gretel alive and well in Berlin, and she's a cocktail waitress and he's something else. And the end of the song goes, and he said something like, "What is his story?" History. And she said, "His story is a wind from the past pushing into the future." I can't sing it for you, but I'll remember it at our song fest. But it's a great song. And we now have this idea of a geist, that is, an animating agency that transforms history and time into something else. And that's part of modernism. Another part of modernism is the idea of the negative, that is, the notion that no longer is consciousness seen as a unique condition, but it has an unconscious that begins to open up into and we understand how important the unconscious is, and we get to Loos and Vienna in the late 19th century and early 20th century. We hit right into Sigmund Freud and the relationship of Freud to Loos and Freud to Wittgenstein and Freud to architecture is going to become very important. You cannot read many modernist tracts without encountering Freud, and then more recently Lacan, and also Freud talks about the idea of the recording of history as a series of layers, palimpsests. He talks about in terms of the idea of the development of cities. He talks about the way we see and understand the world in an essay titled In Plato's Cave, which is very important for architects. But the idea of the negative and that's why the Kachari essay is very important, because Kachari says that once we have nihilism, then it's no good. In other words, we cannot ever realize the unconscious. And the whole issue of psychoanalysis is to understand the balance between our unconscious desires and our conscious capacity to deal with those unconscious desires. And that balance, that is, without suppressing the unconscious, because the minute you suppress something, it comes out to bite you in some way. And having been in 20 years of analysis, I do know something about the unconscious and the suppression of it, and you can see it manifest in architecture when expressionism is rampant, when the unconscious takes hold of individuals. So modernism is about, and it is in Hegel and Kant, in Nietzsche, in all of 19th century philosophy, the notion of the unconscious. The unconscious brings with it the idea of the negative, the yin and the yang, the shadow, lots of different things. And with the idea of this dialectic that is between consciousness and unconscious, the individual and the mass, comes this idea of criticality. Now, we've been talking about what are the critical elements in Bramante, Brunelleschi, Palladio, Rinaldi, etc. But this was not conscious. Any of the critical, what we read looking back as critical elements and what makes them interesting to us is read from our point of view. Criticality is part of the way we see and think. And so we interpret history not as facts, but as almost a psychological necessity to understand where we are in the condition today. So criticality is something that comes introduced basically in Kant's three critiques. And what Kant defines in a very short sense as the critical is the possibility of knowledge in knowledge. That is, if there is something called knowledge, there is something that lies within it, some unconscious villain, a will to become. And so that will to become is the possibility of becoming. And so criticality is the possibility in knowledge of knowledge. And therefore, if we transfer easily to architecture, we can say that criticality is the possibility of architecture in architecture. That is, the unconscious manifestations of architecture that make it possible. And there are so many situations of the unconscious in literature. In Shakespeare is ridden with them. King Lear is a figure shrouded in unconscious doubt. Hamlet is a figure in unconscious doubt. Iago is a shadow figure to Othello. We can read in Moby Dick is a shadow animal, shadow mammal to Captain Ahab. He is obsessed with this unseen labyrinth, which is the whale. And the unseen labyrinth is the architecture possibility. That is the possibility that you can discover in the universe of architecture, in the unconscious of architecture, its possibilities. And that's what makes the modernist project such an exciting project, because it deals with criticality, it deals with the unconscious, it deals with history in a very different way, it deals with the autonomy of the discourse. In other words, the possibility of something within something means that that something has the possibility to become internally with itself, and the whole issue of autonomy is another issue that we will deal with before the end of the term. So now we're finally coming to the consciousness of critical elements. In other words, you might have been saying, why are we discussing criticality? It wasn't a conscious term. It is a conscious term for us. It's still in place. And one of the discussions that goes on in architecture is, are we in the post-critical? Are we in the post-philosophical? Are we in the post-disciplinary? And also, are we in the post-negative? I would argue that as long as the human psyche has a shadow, the negative will always exist. And the attempts at recent critics to suppress the negative is part of what always happens in society, to suppress the other. And of course, we've had enough suppression of the other in our own society, in European Western society, in Middle Eastern society, to understand that the other, the shadow, the negative, the unconscious, plays an enormous role in the world. The two great symbolic myths, one is Narcissus, that describes this idea of the unconscious. And supposedly Narcissus looks into a pool and sees himself. I mean, of course, the question is, how does he know it's him, number one? But he assumes, because he's a narcissist, that that beautiful face he sees in the pool is who he is. But of course, it's only a reflection of who he is. It is not really who he is. But what he doesn't see, because he is a narcissist, is that the water is deep and there's something beneath the reflection, that is the unconscious. And so a narcissist is a person who has trouble seeing the depth, the underside. And that's why the water in psychological terms is always associated with the unconscious. If you have a dream that you're drowning, it means that you are being taken over by the unconscious, and it's not in control. And of course, I stand before you as a unrequited narcissist, who spent a lot of time trying to get by my own reflection in the pool, in my own psychoanalysis. And I would argue that most architects, if they were to examine themselves, or at least most architects that make it out of the morass, have two qualities that are innate. One is narcissism, and the other is egocentrism. Both not very nice characteristics, but necessarily preternatural to a certain amount of success in architecture. You can't be a wimpy, dimpy, mamby-pamby, whatever, and be an architect. I mean, and we're talking women with chops as well as men. I mean, we're now talking, in fact, the men have been the ones that have been turned into recent education, I believe, into the mamby-pambies, but that's a whole other issue which I won't go into. In order to equate men and women, we've sort of lobotomized men in a certain way, but I don't want to get any controversial in this class, certainly not, or be accused of anti-feminist attitudes. The issue is that the narcissistic image is one of the most important for the unconscious. The other is a debate about a Greek sculpture that took place in the 18th century that Piranesi was part of, between Johann Winckelmann, a German art historian, and Gottfried Lessing, a German philosopher. Winckelmann, because we are now in this historicizing idea that things from the past project themselves into the future with a certain amount of energy because the past is thought to have an original quality of truth, goodness, etc., which will be completely shattered when we get to post-structuralist philosophy. That is the question of the value of the origin. But the value of origins is being hotly debated in the 18th century as we are about to break up the known world as we approach 1789 and the French Revolution. And Winckelmann says that the Greek sculpture of the Laocoon, and the Laocoon is a Greek man who betrayed the Greeks in the Trojan horse to the Trojans. In other words, told the Trojans that in fact there were Greeks in the horse. And he was condemned to be strangled with his sons to death by a sea serpent. And there is the very famous Laocoon sculpture of the two sons and the father being strangled by the sea serpent. Winckelmann said the interesting thing about this sculpture and why there's such a discussion and why it's important to our discussion here when we're talking about, if you remember, one of the components is the question of opticality. Winckelmann, as a Neo-Grec, believing in the Greek idea of art, says that the bliss on the face of the Laocoon as he's being squashed by the serpent suggests the most Greek ideals of being able to withstand pain and think about a higher thoughts as death approaches, and that this symbolizes a Greek ideality. Gottfried Lessing, on the other hand, who argues for Romanity, that is, Roman space, says, on the contrary, this has nothing to do with Greek ideality, but rather that the Greeks realize that any expression of agony on the face of Laocoon in the sculpture, the literal expression of like this, would be mawkish, and therefore deny the conceptual condition of grief and anguish that the person was going through. And Lessing says that in fact you can write about anguish and terror, but you cannot express it visually in sculpture because it becomes too literal and therefore loses its dignity. Now that argument about what can be expressed in three-dimensional physical form is with us. In other words, what we can see as opposed to what we can read and think about is with us still today in the question of the optical, and we will continue to talk about it. But its first questioning came in this debate between Lessing as pro-Roman space and Winckelmann as pro-Greek space. And of course, Piranesi gets caught up in this in the sense that he is interested in the idea of Roman space and how one is, makes it possible to present Roman ideality in lithographs, in drawing, and in architecture. And Piranesi therefore introduces a whole new idea of how buildings relate to a city, how buildings relate to space and time and the subject. In Greek space, buildings, if we take the Parthenon as the great example, the Parthenon is never approached frontally. It's always approached from the side, so that the connection between the side and the front, that is the outboard corner, becomes important. And when we're not going to be doing Schinkel, but if you were to look at Schinkel, Carl Friedrich Schinkel, one of the great exponents of neoclassical space, you will realize that to understand Schinkel and to see the way he draws architecture is always from the diagonal, so that we just don't understand a front facade and the side, but we understand the two together, and that the corner view and the recessional view in perspectival space, it becomes and has been important in Greek space. Roman space, on the other hand, is nothing to do with the outboard corner, but has to do with frontality, coming out of the idea of the picture plane in painting. And whereas Roman space is portrayed basically in painting, Greek space is portrayed in sculpture. And so the idea of how you deal with the frontal plane was always a proposition in Roman space. And therefore you get many Roman wall churches and an emphasis, as we saw in Bramante. When I say emphasis now, it means critical emphasis on the internal corner, that is the reentrant corner of the courtyard. So Greek space is interested in the external corner, and how the external corner makes the front and the side relate as a critical idea, whereas Roman space is interested in the reentrant angle and how that corner becomes critical to the understanding of what the architecture wants to be. And of course, the famous Yale master, Louis Kahn, is always the person that says, I do architecture what it wants to be. And of course, Lou was a great mystic, and you know, one needed to understand what God's, I mean, when you were a munchkin like I was, hearing Lou Kahn talk about architecture, what it wants to be, and you say, what the hell is that? I remember Lou's famous phrase when he was talking about the design of the roof and the rear facade of one of his buildings. And the client said, we don't need to worry about that. Nobody sees the roof and the rear facade. And Lou said, God sees the roof. These are all metaphors for understanding that there is this will, internal will, to becoming that architecture has, as you all have an internal will to become. Nietzsche calls it the will to power, I believe. In any case, the debate over Greek and Roman space reaches a kind of apogee in the work of Piranesi, who in fact takes the side of Lessing. And of course, the whole idea of modernism is going to be, the debate over the role of the optical, the role of the visual in sculpture, painting, and architecture, to the point where, as I said, Jasper Johns in 1975 and the death of Marcel Duchamp said that Marcel Duchamp freed painting from a reliance on retinality, that is, the direct experience on the eye of color, texture, surface, and form. That is, Duchamp showed that art, painting and sculpture, could be something other than dominated by retinality. And of course, I believe that the same conditions hold in architecture for when we transfer retinality, which are conditions that impact the eye directly, to opticality, which is the relationship of the space between the seeing subject and the object. And of course, when we get into some psychologists like Lacan, and we talk about the gaze, G-A-Z-E, as something that the object looks back upon the subject, that there's a dialectical condition, that opticality, that is the monocular vision, is no longer the only vision, but it is the condition of the object looking back at the subject. And there's a famous essay by Roland Barthes on the Eiffel Tower where he talks about the possibility of Paris looking back at the subject. So what we're seeing is the objects are now being imbued with a will, a psychological condition of being, where they're no longer merely inanimate, but they have a condition of what they want to be, what something wants to be. And not only that, but they have the capacity now not only to be seen, but to look back. And all of these are conditions that will unfold in modernism, that is the period from 1789 to where we will have certain paradigmatic shifts, that is, variations on what the modern is and what the critical components of it are. But I do not believe if we have had an epistemic shift yet. I mean, I believe that we may have been close to an epistemic shift on 9/11. It's too early to tell. But there is no question that 1789 brought about an epistemic shift, 1914 paradigmatic shift, 1968 paradigmatic shift, 2001 paradigmatic shift perhaps. But we are close to what I consider to be an epistemic shift. And what I would like to think is that the architecture that we are seeing now is the architecture of what I would call